Blog Talk Radio.
And now a brief message from our sponsor. Reality Books presents Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution. The author is Marshall Washington Cabinus Abui, the senior great-grandson of Booker T. Washington. Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution, a message that will change America. Buy your copy today. $20 is all it costs. That's $5 postage and handling. To order your copy of the book written by the great-grandson of Booker T. Washington, Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution, send a text message. Include your full name and how many books you would like to purchase. Send to area code 706-399-5006. Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution. A message that will change America. Send your text message, including your full name and how many books you would like to purchase, to area code 706-399-5006. And now a brief word from our sponsor, Reality Books, publisher of Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution. A short extract from the book, Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution. God will not change the condition of a people until they change what is in themselves. In other words, until they change their way of thinking. Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution is designed to help African Americans and other ethnicities change their way of thinking. This is a book that will change America, and it is on sale for only $20 plus $5 postage and handling. You can order your book now by sending a text message to area code 706-399-5006. Please put your name and the number of books that you would like to order, and you will be contacted to arrange payment information so that the book can be mailed to you immediately. So please go ahead and don't hesitate. Order your copy today. Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution, published by Reality Books. The author of this book is the great-grandson, the senior great-grandson of Booker T. Washington, the founder of the famous Tuskegee Institute in Alabama, now known as Tuskegee University. The great-grandson of Booker T. Washington is inviting you to order his book. Send a text to area code 706-399-5006. The book is only $20 plus $5 postage and handling. Order your copy today. Thank you. Thank you.
Well, good evening, everyone, and welcome again to Booker T. Washington African American Family Room Forum. We're certainly glad that you who have joined us in the family room tonight are present, and we certainly invite all who may have come online via the internet to join us in our actual discussion. We certainly would like to hear your opinion tonight as callers join us, and that means that all of our panelists and all of those who call in can talk about whatever is on your mind. I don't have a specific topic selected because I want to hear what you have been thinking about during the week and what you'd like to share with us. But before we go on any farther, I want to ask our co-host, Ms. Bianchi, welcome to the show again. Always am grateful and happy when I see your number up on the screen. You're the first one that comes in the room, and I'm always happy to have you as our co-host. And so I just want to ask you for a radio check. How can you hear me?
Oh, pretty good, Mr. Washington. I'm a person that always believes in being on time.
I see that. For 4 years, I've seen that. It's been consistent. There's never been a glitch in that. Every week, you're always right on time. Usually about 10 minutes before showtime, you're right there when I open up the show, and I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Absolutely. I remember when I was young, and it would be snowstorms and ice storms, but I still traveled to the job.
Yes, sir.
And apparently
Absolutely.
Somebody was impressed by that.
Well, that's certainly a good characteristic to have, and I'm like that, too, because I was actually raised in an environment where my father, having been a military officer during World War II, you know, he trained me in all of those different characteristics, including timely reporting, being where I'm supposed to be, when I'm supposed to be there on time or even a little early. And so when I went to grade school, the nuns who I actually studied under for the first, for what is it, 8 years of my life, no, 8 plus 1, because I was in kindergarten for a year, they were, you know, they were very sharp, and they required, you know, if they told you to be back in the classroom in 10 minutes, they wanted to make sure that you were there seated in your desk, at your desk, in the right time frame. But I'll thank you so much again, and I do want to say I have been reticent to put this out on the air to start a show with this, and I didn't really feel maybe it was my place to do it, but since I had announced a couple of weeks ago, maybe about a month ago, about my sister-in-law going in the hospital, she passed yesterday, so keep our family in your prayers. Stephanie may or may not come on the show tonight, and I hadn't discussed with her whether I was going to broadcast this, but I feel since you all knew about her sickness that I should bring you up to date. But she did pass peacefully. My wife and I prayed with her as she was making a transition. She wasn't conscious, though. As far as we know, she didn't, you know, maybe inside she may have had a spiritual response, but she was actually in a deep coma. But anyway, so much, you know, has gone on in the last month in that regard, and now there's a burden, you know, that in many ways been lifted off of her, and hopefully our family will get through this, you know, as well as possible in the days to come. But moving on, as I say, it's caller's choice tonight. I see John Canabay is with us, and thank you for being with us tonight, and Brother Warren is with us. Thank you for being with us tonight, and I just want to say anyone who's listening via the internet, many people do like to listen via the internet. I check the stats every week, and usually 3 times as many people are listening via the internet as we actually have calling in. So those who are listening via the internet, we welcome you to call in and tell us whatever might be on your mind. And if you'd like to hear our feedback, our response, we're certainly going to be happy to give you our thoughts on whatever you present. I just noticed that Minister Jesus Muhammad Ali joined us just right now, and we welcome you, Minister Jesus Muhammad Ali. Thank you for joining us. But the number for those who are listening via the internet to call if you want to participate actively is 657-383-0671. Well, I do want to kick the show off with just a really quick something. You know, I don't really like to get involved in discussing quote-unquote politics or religion on the show because people have their own ideas about things like that, and sometimes these ideas are very passionately held, and I'd like to just kind of keep everything on a well-balanced discussion basis instead of having people get upset because somebody doesn't like what their political agenda or thoughts might be or their religious persuasion might be. But here's something that I don't really know if it's something that I want to consider as a political agenda so much as a agenda to make America better. We've been through some rough years over the last, to be honest with you, you know, I've been on this earth for almost 78 years, and we've had a lot of ups and downs. But the last few years with people having deaths in their family from COVID, over 730,000 people have died, I think, since we first had the first COVID outbreak back around January, February of 2020. And people are still dying. Now that young people are be getting sick, some of them are even going into ICUs, and few of them have died, a small percentage, but still. But the reason why I'm bringing this up, and I'm going to move on and give it to Mr. Bianchi to start the show off as far as comments are concerned, is I was just looking at the Build Back Better agenda on the White House webpage, and I just want to share something with you. You may not agree with Biden, you may not like Biden, but this agenda, I'm looking at it, and it says it's an ambitious plan, not just a lot of talking, but a plan to create jobs and cut taxes and lower costs for working families. And I'm a head of a working family, and everybody pretty much that I know are in working families. And it said all paid for by making the tax code fair and making the wealthiest and large corporations pay their fair share. You know, I pay a big chunk of my monthly income in taxes, and I'm almost 78 years old. I'm still paying some taxes on my Social Security check. Fortunately, my VA disability payments are not tax, but my Navy retirement is tax, and you know, we pay our taxes because that's the law. We do what's right. But when I read about wealthy people finding all kinds of ways not to pay taxes, I kind of feel like I'm getting the bad end of the deal. So this program, according to what I'm reading, is supposed to help level the playing field so the wealthy are paying some taxes. You know, really, I don't say they should be paying 70%, 80% of their income, but they definitely need to be paying something. But, you know, when I look at this agenda, it says lower child care costs and lower higher education costs. I'm still involved in higher education, not just as a professor, but also as a doctoral student. And I'm paying tuition out of my income that I make. So I'd like to see that go down. And then lower prescription drug costs. Well, fortunately, Medicare and TRICARE, which is a military health program, is taking care of my drug costs. I don't have to pay that out of pocket. But I think of what I would be having to pay if I did have to pay out of pocket, what millions of Americans are having to pay that really don't have high incomes. And then lower health care costs. Fortunately, as I said, I get my health care for me and my family, my wife and myself, taken care of through the military. In my case, you know, through Medicare. She's not going to start Medicare till March. But fortunately, the military and Medicare help us out. We don't have to come out of pocket for hardly anything. But so many people can't even afford to go see a doctor. They have to make a decision whether I want to go see a doctor about some ailment or whether I'm going to buy some shoes for my kids. That's not right. And then lower housing costs and so forth and so on. I won't go any further, but I'm just saying, oh, yeah, and it is something in here about creating jobs, workforce training, you know, they talk about a lot of our people would rather draw these long-term unemployment checks rather than go to work. Well, I don't know anybody that falls in that category, and I know a lot of people. You know, everybody that I know would like to do something every day productive. They don't want to sit home and get in front of a plasma TV and watch shows or watch cartoons or watch whatever. People like to be doing something, but people do need to get specialized training, especially in this high-tech world. So I'm in favor of that. Clean energy jobs. Ms. Bianca, you know a lot more about these things regarding energy than I do, but the very fact you know that we're having a lot of these weather issues, and some of the people I've talked to and I've read about say a lot of it's related to things that are happening in the atmosphere, dealing with things like pollution and other issues, you know, causing climate change. So even out in California, they just passed a rule that I think it's like maybe within the next 10 years, nobody's going to be able to sell, at least the dealers are not going to be able to sell cars that operate off gasoline because of the pollution out there. So jobs in creating clean energy need to be produced. And then finally on here is investments in teachers and schools. Well, I'm a teacher and I work at a school, and I'd love to get a break on my student loans if that's part of that agenda. So I don't see anything really political about this, even though some people may say it is political. To me, that's just a program to help the middle class, the average Americans, to be able to do better. Anyway, you don't have to comment. I just had to get that off my chest because everything on there I agree with. But some people may say, no, that's just a lot of baloney. They're just trying to, you know, appeal to voters and this kind of thing. Yeah, well, they are appealing to me, to be honest. Anyway, Mr. Bianchi, thank you again for being patient because it's your turn. So you can take it away, and it's open mic, so anything that's on your mind, please share.
Well, you know, you talk about those income taxes. You pick a bone with me on that. I was so glad to see Donald Trump and his tax plan. It helped quite a bit, especially with the line of business. You know, the top 50% of taxpayers pay about 97% of all income taxes. And those at the bottom 50% probably pay 2.9% of the, according to last reports. But I don't have any problem with people making a lot of money and legally avoiding income tax as much as they possibly can. Heck, I've done it. And as a business do better to keep that money in their pocket where they can reinvest in the company, take on larger projects, thus by paying more in wages and salaries to workers. I think that one of the problems with these student loans, and of course I can't speak for everybody, is that when you're talking about blacks, now of course other ethnic groups, they don't fall in that category. But I think a lot of things goes back to a reflection of how these young people are being educated and what they're being educated for. I'm sure that you would agree on that. If you're majoring in low-paying majors and you're taking an exuberant amount of time to obtain that, well, everything beyond the dedicated normal period is going to be an added burden. And know the burdens add up over a length of time. So all these things have a play together, Mr. Washington. When you have, starting with a lack of the functional family, and this is for any ethnic group, if you got a lack in a functional family, then that inappropriateness is going to be telescoped right on down the line. And it shows. So I'm going to go with that. And I give my condolences to your sister-in-law. That wasn't Stephanie, was it?
No, Stephanie's sister. My my sister-in-law, Stephanie's sister, is one that passed. Stephanie, she's fine as far as her health is concerned. I mean, we all got issues here and there, but, I mean, she's okay. But it was her sister, her older sister, that passed.
Oh, okay. Well, hopefully everything is okay.
Yes, and appreciate your feedback. And so we'll go around the family room and say, John, Ken, and Bay, you don't have to respond to what I said. You don't have to respond to what Ms. Bianca said unless you want to. You can introduce a whole brand new topic, whatever's on your mind. But please go ahead. Thank you for being with us tonight.
Good evening, everyone. Actually, I've thought about both of those topics, but it looked at from two points of view. Maybe I said one point of view is looking at the way the haves look at it, then look at the way the have not look at it. A lot of the haves, if you go trace their history, you'll find out there's a point when they didn't have either, especially a lot of the immigrants that came from Europe. And a lot of them came from Europe at the time that a large amount of our people were in slavery, worked for nothing, had land, lost their land. So the playing field has been uneven for a long period of time in terms of economics. In terms of services, these services are, other countries have similar challenges and obligations, and it seems like in some countries, particularly in Europe, they do a better job in distributing the wealth with their people and valuing their talent and contribute to the development of talent through education, healthcare systems, all of that. So I think that the politics is unbalanced, and the media, what gets the information gets out about what's going on is slanted toward lies of untruth, conjectures, so forth and so on. And whether it's class or race, either way, it's a problem that needs to be attacked, needs to be looked at it. And you can't keep shoving it down the road at some point. And the impact it's having on different generations, I see particularly, I was having a discussion with someone in reference to a short truck driver. And the person I was talking to, they have a business, land care business. In fact, I'm a part business owner myself, and I pay much more taxes that I need or should pay, and being part of a company, an LLC, be a reversal of what the obligation of taxes is concerned. I'm paying taxes on money that is not taken out of the company, used in the company to grow the company. So there are a lot of inequities in this whole situation. It has a lot to do with fairness. Fairness. You know, the statement made, well, it's legal. Is it fair? Who made it legal? Who made it unlegal? Who wrecked the legislature? Who's influenced it? In fact, a lot of legislatures don't even write it. They have lobbyists write it. So it's a lot of unfairness, downright criminal. Well, I take that back. Forgive me for saying that. But anyway, that's my comment.
Thank you so much for sharing. Say, John Kennebay, before we go to Brother Warren, because I'm definitely anxious and sitting here on the edge of my seat, so to speak, I always like to hear everyone's comments, and certainly looking forward to Brother Warren's. But before I bring you on, Brother Warren, I just want to let our internet listeners know the number again to call in if they want to participate. If you want to participate and you're listening right now via the internet, the number to call in is 657-383-0671. Again, 657-383-0671. So again, welcome to the show, Brother Warren, and it's all yours, and you can just share whatever's on your mind with us that you would like to share.
I want to say greetings to everyone. The weather is very nice here, nice fall breeze, cool breeze. And, you know, that weather makes your attitude better. You know, you're not on edge. When it gets hot and humid down here, it kind of makes you a little agitated. But it was a nice day today, and worked in the yard and just pretty much, you know, lounged around. But what I wanted to share with you, I mentioned on last week I had purchased a book called Red, White, and Black, Rescuing American History from Revisionists and Race Hustlers. And it was put together by Robert Woodson. He's the editor. And Robert Woodson and some other black conservatives started an initiative called 1776 Unite, which is supposed to be a response to the 1619 Project. And so this book consists of over 20-something essays, no more than maybe 3 or 4 page each, by an eclectic mix of black people from different backgrounds. But they all have in common is their disdain for the 1619 Project. And so the articles, now I'm the kind of person, I like to go to the opposing view per people and see what they have to offer. I'm looking for their, so basically, to sum up the essays, they all, except for two essays I'm going to share with you what the contents of that, they all attack this idea that is brought out in the 1619 that the United States was founded on racism. They all attack that. I guess that's part of the qualification to do your essay. And then some of them dabble with history a little bit, but then they go right back into the black-on-black crime and all this whole kind of stuff. They go into and victimhood, you're playing victimhood. So in the opening forward by this guy, I don't know who, and a lot of these people are not even really heard of, really. You know, they some of them are academics, some of them are community activists for the conservative side, this whole kind of thing. But one of the essays in the beginning said this. This person was the forward, I believe. I never heard of him. Piazza, you may have heard of him. I was looking for one of your essays in here, but I didn't see it. Dr. Lucas Morrell in the foreword. And this is another thing, too, Mr. Washington. It's like the only well-known black people was Frederick Douglass. They all talk about Frederick Douglass, and they mention Abraham Lincoln as if that was the only well-famous African-American. But anyway, in this paragraph, in this guy's foreword, he says, an essential theme of these essays is the importance of the individual as contrasted with the more popular emphasis upon group identity. One of the grand ironies of today's identity politics is that the solidarity or collective mindset promoted by appeals to race pride ignores the individual identities of those it claims to elevate. Moreover, it also neglects or downplays the diversity of each individual whose true identity could never be summed up by reference only to race or any other attribute. In doing so, today's racial identity mongers undermine substantive advancement of racial minorities by not calling forth their individual efforts to develop their national capacity for self-government. So here you see another thing that these black conservatives do. They attack black people's group identity. They don't attack other people's group identity, right? So they attack black people's group identity, and they castigate blacks for identifying with a group, which is a contradiction in all these essays, because if blacks are individuals, why are you writing essays to attack black people as a group? So I wonder what he thinks about the anti-Asian hate bill, which is something specifically designed for Asians. I wonder what he got to say about that. And I wonder what he got to say about the Asian businesses where they themselves monopolize particular industries for themselves and promote their group identity. But nonetheless, that's just one thing. Another thing that comes out is this term called victimization. This is what they use this a lot. Now look at this logic, Mr. Washington. You're walking down the street, somebody hits you over the head, take your money, even sodomize you. You bruised up, you're bleeding, and you walking around talking about, I ain't no victim, I ain't no victim. The police is actually investigating a crime. A crime was committed against you, and the police is investigating, and you're going around saying you're not a victim, but one can see the visible trauma on your physical body of the crime. What has been done to black people in the United States and around the world by white people based on their race in all areas of people activity, as one elder would say, economics, education, labor, law, politics, entertainment, sex, race, war, has been a crime against humanity. And when you commit a crime to a person, collectively a group of people, they have scars. They have not only physical scars, they have psychological scars. But black people are not supposed to talk about that. If they do, they are playing the victim. Isn't that interesting? And yet black people are forced to watch television, news stories of white people bitching and whining all over the country about stuff like wearing masks, about stuff like what their kids are going to learn in school about other people's history. And they really act like they're victims. And these same black people who attack black people as playing the victimhood sympathize with those whites who are traumatized because they got to wear a mask in public. So these black conservatives should not be respected. They don't even mention W.B. Du Bois. Now they claim in these essays that they were trying to offer an alternative to the gloom and doom that the 1619 Project supposedly paints. And they want to show stories of African-American resilience. But notice how they selectively leave out some of the most significant black people who have contributed to black people's freedom, like W.E.B. Du Bois. But he's not going to be mentioned by these guys because he examined the issue of race and racism in America and its impact on black people. So we got to scrap him. So you see how dishonest they are, these so-called black conservatives? They are willing to distort the historical record to be the cheerleaders for racism and to be the new set of race hustlers that they accuse. See, they're race hustlers too. They just want to replace the race hustlers that they don't like. And they want to benefit under the sponsorship of the whites they think gonna get in power. So I just want to share that. Yeah, I'm gonna throw the book in the trash can or hand it off to somebody or drop it off at the Goodwill. It doesn't do anything for me intellectually. It's something you can just pass on to somebody. They are fraudulent. Robert Woodson is a race hustler, okay? And he and other race hustlers, they are aspiring to replace the race hustlers, you know, the ones we used to that are identified with the Democratic Party and the civil rights organizations. Well, I don't think race hustler is necessarily a negative thing when you look back at it, Mr. Washington. Now, let me give you an example. Your grandfather made a prescient quote about those black people who make a career out of talking about the problem, and that if they don't do that, they'll be out of a job. But I thought about that, Mr. Washington. Think about it. You lived in Alabama, 1910. Your child gets lynched. You and your wife grieving. Some black person comes out to let everybody know about it. Somebody's giving you attention that a crime was committed against you. Mr. Washington had to play politics to give the impression that he was not concerned for that. That's how he survived in Alabama with that institution. But think about it, a parent of a child that was lynched by these people cannot go along with that. No, imagine this. Okay, your child was lynched, and some black people are coming to console you and to try to find some sort of redress for you. Would they take out a quote of Booker T. Washington? Y'all are race hustlers. Y'all just should. No. They're being given a their case where they need help about their child's murder is being given attention. So some of this race hustler business has helped a lot of black people. It has given black people a voice in injustice that many of the black people who are sitting up with the white people cutting deals don't want to touch out of fear of eliminating their privileged position close to the whites. So some of this race hustler stuff hasn't been bad at all. Okay, and like any endeavor, you're going to have people that exploit it for their own individual end. I don't think all race hustlers, if that's what you want to use, have been ineffective. I think many race hustlers have helped. And we want to call Martin Luther King a race hustler. He had helped. And other people who work with King who may choose to be called race hustlers. So even that term race hustler is a way to condemn black people who dare speak out against injustice against black people. It's an attempt to intimidate through language those who dare to confront the system. Bob Woodson and the rest of these people benefit from a certain group of whites for defending their white people's racist position. They give comfort to white people. They make white people feel good about the fact that they screw over black people, and there's a group of black people who are patting them on the back and saying it is their fault over there. That's all I want to say, Mr. Washington. Thank you.
I appreciate that. I just want, we're going to stop at 9 o'clock tonight, so we'll have a chance for everybody to chime in and give new perspectives on what has been said or introduce something new. And we can talk about it until, you know, we get to 9 o'clock, and I want to stop at 9 o'clock. But I do want to say this. I listen very, very carefully to everything you say and all of the panelists say, Brother Warren. But here's the thing. Now, this is an older man talking, you know, 78 in less than 2 months. Not an old man, but an older man. And not to get into a biographical sketch of my history or anything like that, but see, when I grew up in Tuskegee, we had a lot of people who had reached the what we call middle-class lifestyle that were professors and staff workers at the campus at Tuskegee. And in a material sense, they had made it just about as good as the average white person was going to make it in terms of having a new car, a beautiful home, you know, money in the bank, et cetera, et cetera. But they weren't happy. And the reason why they weren't happy was because of the fact that they were treated not as second-class citizens, not as third-class citizens, but as non-citizens. They were not treated with respect by the sheriff of the county, by the mayor, by the judge down at the courthouse, by white people in general. There were exceptions to the rule, but in general, that even when their trophy wife women would go downtown to shop for a dress, where they would let the white store would let the white women go in the room and try on the dress, they wouldn't let this trophy wife of this black professor do it just because of the color of her skin, because of her racial background. And this was disheartening to these women, and they, of course, would take these complaints home to their men, and the men would get mad because they worked very hard to get this level of respect they weren't getting. And eventually it led to the civil rights movement getting kicked off in Tuskegee, and I went to a lot of the mass meetings, and you hear a lot of these complaints, and not just from the middle class, but even the maids and the people that worked in the menial, what they call menial jobs. I don't think any job is menial, But I'm just saying that in general, you know, our people were then, and in many cases today, still treated very badly. And what Du Bois was all about, and why he really had issues with my great-grandfather, was because my great-grandfather mistakenly thought that if we achieved this middle-class type of oasis that Tuskegee, the black side of Tuskegee, developed into, that white people would respect our women when they went down to shop and would not make them stand outside of the store while white women came in freely. And then when the white women left, then they would let this trophy wife of this college professor come in. So, you know, he was wrong. And if I was living during his time, you know, I was in the Black Nation of Islam, and I would have told him and said, you know, you need to quit trusting those white people so much, because just like what really happened to him when Teddy Roosevelt let him down after the Brownsville incident, when Booker T. Washington tried to get Roosevelt to convene a special commission, since the Army didn't want to have a court martial to give those black soldiers a chance to vindicate themselves for being unjustly accused of starting a riot and killing some white people, which they did not start a riot, and they did not kill those white people, but they never had a chance to prove it in any type of court. And Booker T. Washington naively mistook Roosevelt's political savvy for friendship. And I would have told him, say, look, Granddaddy, you know, those people are playing you. They're playing you like what do you call it, you know, like a chump. And he finally realized it, and then he started getting more militant to the extent that he could without getting killed, which I believe eventually white people put some black folks up to kill him anyway. But I'm just saying that, man, here's my point. Our people need to wake up as a people, but we're not even a people. We call ourselves a people, but a people has a common history relationship that they can identify with, like the Jews identify with, not just the Holocaust, but going all the way back to Abraham. And we came from hundreds of different tribes and gotten merged up together, separated from our tribal backgrounds. And the only thing we had in common was that we were slaves, and if we weren't slaves, we were considered to be less than human. But we never did develop any kind of group consciousness except because of those issues. And they did get us through. You know, we had a sense of solidarity and segregation much more than today. But my final statement I want to say about this, to cap off what I've been trying to get out, is that we have to understand that the nature of human relations is that people in society band together for protection, security, and advancement of the group that they belong to at the expense of all other groups, unless they are allied with these other groups to help them further their agenda. But black people have had temporary allies, but those allies that never want us to have the kind of solidarity that Elijah Muhammad wanted us to have, because they wanted to ally with us only so they could use us for their own benefit. We're in a terrible shape, and I don't think I'm going to see a change in my lifetime, but what I will like to leave everyone with is this. God says in the Quran that He would not change the condition of a people until they change what's in their hearts and in their minds. And until we start seeing ourselves as being people that should do the things that all other people are doing, you alluded to this, Brother Warren, is identifying as a solid group so we can be able to have a voice at the table as a group. And we're just going to keep on getting played over and over and over again. And finally, Du Bois said that our education system should help to make us be recognized as human beings. And then after our people went and got bachelor's and master's degrees, became engineers and chemists, and I had the opportunity to hear my stepfather, who was a professor and had several degrees, including a PhD, and he also had certifications in psychology in addition to his chemistry PhD. He told me he was very bitter. He was about 5 years from his death, and he was very bitter. After all he had accomplished, he said to the average white man, the most highly credentialed black man is still just another nigger. So even though you boys thought that all this education would make us see ourselves and others see us as more human, it has not happened in a massive way as what he had dreamed of. So what are we going to do about it? I'll leave you with that thought. And then you can take it off, or we can talk about anything you want to talk about. We'll go back to Mr. Bianchi.
Well, Mr. Washington, you got an echo there.
Yeah, no, I don't think the echo is on my end.
I just heard it.
Let me just check.
But you know, I heard the story. You say I didn't experience nothing. All blacks didn't experience those things. I take my hat off to you for being able to go through that. You know, we've heard about it, but whether we experience it, all don't experience those things. You know, the funny thing you mentioned about Booker T. Washington, that type of jealousy and animosity existed then amongst groups, amongst some, especially with Du Bois and Garvey, where he called him a little monkey and sick the FBI on him. I think they've done the same thing to Mr. Washington, too, did they, or did they not? It skips my mind right now.
But he definitely had his enemies. We won't go into that history because we don't have a lot of time. But we can talk about it another time.
Yeah, Du Bois taught classes at Tuskegee. So Du Bois would go, Booker T tried to get Du Bois full time over at Tuskegee.
Well, yeah, not only that, but Du Bois lived in Booker T. Washington's house while he was teaching those classes.
Yeah, Du Bois and then represented the NAACP. Du Bois was a mulatto, had a white father, black mother, so he was, during the time in the city where he grew up in Great Barrington, Massachusetts,
Year. Du Bois was not biracial. That's not true, Pianchi. Du Bois' family was black on both
biracial.
Sides. No, it was not biracial. That's not true. That's inaccurate. That's inaccurate.
Well,
let me say what
I've been told. Du Bois had a white father and his mother.
No, that's
was
not
black.
True. That's not true.
Not wrong.
That's not true. That's not true.
Okay, well, all right. Well, anyway, he come from Great Barrington, Massachusetts, and every year that town would send 10 of the brightest male students to Harvard, and he got sent down to Fisk. Because they wouldn't allow him. He didn't get to go to Harvard that year. But, you know, Mr. Washington, and you know me, myself, of course, I've done some unusual things in my profession, especially in the industry. And 95% of my workforce are white males. Worked with them all my life. And worked them in some peculiar positions where one slip move, I could have failed to my death, or they could have failed to their death. And it was a wonderful experience. I got letters from some that they acclaimed me as being the greatest employer that they ever worked for. But, you know, getting off to something else, you know, back in 1953, Dwight Eisenhower signed Executive Order 10219. And it mandates the preservation of air, rail, motor, and maritime military resource in peacetime to ensure that the military capacity of wartime. And along came Ronald Reagan in 1987 and mandated the Department of Defense the use of commercial air carriers to provide airlift capability and capacity. And now today, the Department of Defense has commercial U.S. partners for every modality
that they use, and that would include the air, sea, and rail, except for one, and that's air-to-air refueling. So I was asked today by a friend who's a commercial pilot. He's black, and he's a co-founder with some other, another black, and I think three whites. Well, they're starting a company that's going to provide air-to-air refueling, which is a good thing. And I'm trying to find them an investment banker, and I think I know somebody who can help them. And by 2025, that market is going to be worth $24.5 billion. And that's just one of the opportunities that exist in this great country called the United States of America. And, you know, somebody made mention about the Asian hate bill. Well, Afghanistans are Asian. Russians are Asians. Spanish are Asian. British and French really are Asian because there was no Europe as a continent at the time. Mid-Easterners are Asian.
That's not referring to those people. That's referring to people from
It said Asians in the bill.
Yeah, but that but a person from France and Spain.
Mr. Carter, why do you always want to argue with me?
Mr. Who?
When you talking, I never said a word.
No, you said Mr. Who?
When you was talking, I never said a word.
Well, let me intervene. Brother Warren, let Ms. Piyaki finish, and then if you want to refute statements when he's done, you can take all the time you want. I said we were going to stop
now. I'm going to be quiet.
You can take all the time you want to take his arguments apart.
You live all week long to come challenge me?
Yeah, I apologize.
If you want to do it on his time, but it's not his time yet. It's your time. Go ahead, Ms. Piyaki.
Yeah, that's what I was trying to get a point across. Now, like I was saying before, there's many opportunities in some of these out-of-box occupations. Me, myself, I was a structural steel erector. I put up bridges across rivers, railroads, highways, and industrial centers for the likes of Ford Motor Company and the U.S. Geospatter, which is usually ran by the Corps of Engineers, and multi-story office buildings. And I wasn't the only one in support for that particular business, that particular industry. And there's a lot of industry out there that blacks are starting to get involved in. And I work with those that happen to come to me and ask for their assistance. We help to develop and do the logistics for seaports for Nigerian countries, actually one, and also provide other industries in poultry for the river states in Nigeria. So the opportunities exist. If people want to take advantage of them and prepare for them, there's no reason why more shouldn't. As I said before, Afghanistans are Asians. And as Mary Tillman on a show in Chicago yesterday, she used to be the older person in Chicago, and she was one of the people who mimicked the bill that was passed out there. I think it was Proposition 8. The slave era bill in California, where they had one in Chicago too that she introduced, that required corporations to go back into their history of their company and see if they profited off of slavery. And she made reference about the Afghans coming under the Asian hate bill. Anybody come from the continent of Asia, that's who it applied to. And as I said before, young people today, you know, Mr. Washington, I think Tuskegee is involved in the Mars project, utilizing some of the things that George Washington Carver techniques that he put forth. and that being with the potato, the sweet potato. It needs to be more research going on like that. And with effort, I think we're going to be able to do it. Oh, and there's another African-American. Well, actually, he's Nigerian-American. He's starting an airplane dealership, him and another black man. His wife is white. And a beautiful couple in North Carolina. I think he may be the only airplane dealer in the United States. Well, he's selling one particular model, but he's selling all models, really. So that's my point I wanted to get across, is that the opportunities exist, take advantage of them, or somebody going to ask you what you're going to do. Thank you, Mr. Washington.
Okay, I just want to interject this, and then we're going to move around the table. We're going to get you, Brother Juan, but next person in line is St. John Kennedy, but I just want to mention this. I've got, Du Bois' biography, two-volume biography by David Levering Lewis in my hand. I was just looking up Du Bois' parentage, and the book actually doesn't say what race he was, but he said that Du Bois' father, Alfred Du Bois, came from San Domingo, Haiti. I can't go any further than that right now because it said that you know he was colored. Well, if his father had been a mulatto, if he was white, still he would have been considered colored if his mother, you know, being black. But I'm still researching to find out, you know, more about his father in terms of Alfred and what Alfred's race would have been considered back in those days up there. So maybe I have some more information about that.
Well, Alfred was a chapter. Mulatto. Mulatto.
Yeah.
Out of Dominican
Republic,
if
he was
like
mulatto,
he could have passed
as
white.
He wasn't white if he was mulatto. Because my grandparents was classified on my mother's side. This is Booker T. Washington's son and my grandmother back in the 1920s during that census, and they was considered on the census. I've seen a copy of it as mulattoes, but they was still considered being Negroes, even though they did have privileges that a lot of Negroes didn't have, because back in those days, mulattoes, depending on circumstances, sometimes got treated just a tad better than the average black person. And I can just say this, and I'm going to turn it over to Sheikh John. But I remember, because my grandmother was so white-looking, I mean, her brother actually passed for white all his life as a lawyer up in Chicago, Robert Merriweather. But when we would go downtown to the store, the field workers would come in on wagons, trucks and wagons, on shopping day on Saturday. And the main store that they would go to would be the Woolworths 5 and 10 cent store. And get little things, you know, to take back to their, you know, places of residence, to the shacks or whatever little housing that the master of the plantation gave them. And the white folks would make the black people sit outside or stand outside and come in like one or two at a time, and they would watch them like a hawk. Whereas when my grandmother went down there, because I was with her, so that's why I noticed, they just let her come in just like the white women. Because being a lot of them look like a white person, they gave her that extra little privilege. But as far as, you know, what Brother Juan was saying, you know, a mulatto is not considered and was never considered to be a white person. So the statement that he made to say that Du Bois' father wasn't white, that was correct. Now, I agree. I haven't found it in his book yet. But more than likely, he was a mulatto, but that's not the same as being white. And I don't think that Du Bois ever said in any context that his father was other than what we would call a Negro. But anyway, I just wanted to say that I was looking that up.
You know, back in those times, I don't think that they – I think that the key thing is that the man was a human being. What was the lady name that helped them start the NAACP? Spengard? No, Spengard was a Jewish.
Mary Overton.
Yeah, Mary Overton was white. Spengard was white. You know, whites have done some people that have done, human beings have done some marvelous things in history, happen to be of all different skin colors, including whites. Hey, look how hard
about,
the British, look how hard.
Yeah, brother one, he was referring to me. You're going to have all the time. I'm going to let you have even almost the whole hour when he finished, because we want to go ahead and go to Shay John as quick as we can so we can keep it moving.
White's done things historically good for others, as others have done historically good for them. Heck, look at the British. They worked since the late 1870s up until 1908, close to 1920, to stop traditional slavery in some of those African countries, especially Ghana. It was British that worked to stop indigenous slavery in Ghana. So apparently they seen something that was probably not right, and they worked to stop it. And of course, they had a hard time because it's something that's been going on for a long time, and the people themselves that was behind it and also made money off and whatever, they didn't want to. But that's life. You make the best of it that you can today, like so many are. Thank you.
Okay, we're going to go ahead and keep moving. Thank you very much. You know, I have a little quick anecdote, but I'm going to hold it until we go around, and then I may say what I want to say about my ancestor. But the thing is, this is time for us to keep moving. So, Sheikh John Kenan Bey, I'm sorry we had taken so much time before we got to you, but there were some things that need to be ironed out, and they still need to be ironed out. But we definitely want to hear your comment as we get ready to close. So please go ahead with anything you want to add.
Yes, I want to speak on a post that was made on Facebook, and it's something that Malcolm said, Malcolm X. He said this: the slave master no longer has to whip, shoot, lynch, rape, poison, and brainwash you. He has taught you to do it yourself. I responded to that, and I want to just read my response. I said, I might get in trouble with my people for saying this. Brother Malcolm comes down the line of a number of great thinkers. The greatest is Prophet Noble Dwali. If you have the courage to embrace his truth, you can free your mind from mental slavery. Good people, the European is not your God who created your ancient forefathers. P.S. When you call the European white, you honor him as your God. Peace.
Say, John, are you going to stop with that, or are you going to add more?
No, I'm stopping with that. That's all I need to say for tonight.
Okay, well, fine. That sounds really, really strong, and definitely we need to take that into consideration. So thank you so much. And now, Brother Warren, you have all the time you want to take to refute what you heard Ms. Bianca say or add more to what you want to say. It's all yours.
One of the reasons why that I unfortunately interrupt is I'm very impatient with inaccurate statements. And Mr. Bianca does that a lot. He gives a lot of inaccurate information about the African-American experience. And the comment about Du Bois's father, I don't know where that came from. The term mulatto was just a color term. It was no legal status at all. A black person who looked white, and it was known that that person was of African ancestry, was a nigger, just like everybody else. Now, I come from the land of so-called mulattoes here in New Orleans. I grew up with grandparents and aunts and uncles who looked like white people. They were angry black people at how black people were treated. Because if you didn't pass for white, meaning that if you were around the white people and didn't know you were black, that was the only way. But once the whites found out you were classified as Negro, you were as much a nigger as the darkest black person. Then we had a first black mayor. In fact, Mark Morial of the Urban League, his father was the first black mayor. His father's name was Ernest Dutch Moriel. Looked like a white man, like Alan Clayton Powell. Ernest Moriel used to be a lawyer. He was a civil rights lawyer. And I know about this because we grew up in the same neighborhood, around the corner from each other. Mr. Moriel was in the front of his house. And the white police came by and said, "Get in the house, nigga." He didn't get in the house. And they beat him to a pulp. Looked like a white man, just like them. The minute my family told my cousins, my father told my sisters, if you ever get around a white man, you let them know immediately that you are black. Because some of the light-skinned females who tried to sneak and pass for white as a joke may go try to go with a white man. Once that white man found out he was black, they would beat them. Mulatto was just a color term that the white folk came up with. It was not a legal term. Du Bois's great-grandfather was white man who impregnated his slaves, like many of us have that history in our family. On the NAACP, Du Bois left the NAACP because he saw that at the end point, there were not those white people, those good white people, Mr. Tianchi, that you said good, he realized they were not for the full, black people's full development. They wanted to hover over black people and keep them at a certain point. William Monroe Trotter warned Du Bois about them in the first place. I have a cousin, Mr. Washington. She's in her 70s. She looks like a white woman, indistinguishable. Back during school desegregation in the early 60s, she happened to go to a school that was for white people. It was an elementary school. The white teachers would walk around the building and say, "Where's the nigger?" So they had to literally go up to her and say, "That's the nigger there." So my cousin said she was going to write a book called "That's the Nigger There." That's all she heard every time. "Where's that little nigger girl that's here?" Because she was so indistinguishably white from the white kid, they had to go up to her and say, "That's the nigger there." And Mr. Piaggi doesn't know anything about so-called a lot of people. He's never been around them. He don't know the frustration, the experiences that they have, the discrimination, the beatings by the police. During Reconstruction, when the white people, they call them the Redeemers, begin to galvanize to intimidate black people for registering to vote, there's a town called Opelousas. Nothing but a lot of people. Free blacks, many of them were free. Many of them had been free blacks. White folk came through there and lynched over 200 of them. They were Negroes. PBS Pinchback, our first black governor, looked like a white man, was a Negro. So there was no legal status for a mulatto. It was just simply, just like during slavery. Did you know? They had slaves who looked like white children, white people on the auction block. They looked just like white people. One of my ancestors was stolen from Maryland. She was a fancy girl. That's what they call the light-skinned girls that they purchased, fancy girls. They were sold just like the jet black people. We have to understand this. Adam Clayton Powell was an angry black man. His father was an angry black man. All mulattoes didn't walk around like this stuff didn't stink. You know, many of them had race pride. Adam Clayton Powell, one of the first ones to say, "Black is beautiful. I'm black." You need to understand that. These people don't know enough history about the African American experience, the complexity and the diversity underneath the segregation and the racism. Many black people's early leaders in the churches and their teachers were what you call mulatto people and taught pride to black children, colored children at the time. Looked like white people. That's all we got. But you see, this generation of African-American church, they don't know about that. So when they see pictures of those people, they doubt that they're black. We have done a very poor job of really educating our young people about the experience of being black in America.
We have done a horrible, horrible job. Now, young people, so when I hear these inaccuracies, I have to react. I just have to respond sometime because, and another comment that was just made that was a very hard comment, color didn't matter back then. That was a statement I just heard just a while ago, Mr. Washington. Color or so, what didn't matter back then? Du Bois was the most educated black person probably in the world. He was our intellectual par excellence. And at the end of the day, he died a bitter, angry black man at the apparent look that he sees of the permanence of racism. Yeah, he may have gotten a little highfalutin, like he felt his education and maybe his lighter complexion entitled him to be a leader of the masses. That was a big thing with him and Garvey. He was envied of Garvey, and he was envied of Booker T. He was envied because much of the education black people had in these institutions kind of taught them to see themselves as a colored white person, and that therefore they are entitled to stand above the masses as the leaders. And Du Bois kind of had that little habit that was hard to break. I was told he couldn't even really talk to the average black person. He was pretty much a snob. And some of those universities, Mr. Washington, Wilberforce, and others, I heard sometimes them black professors would sit down for lunch and speak Greek and Latin. And if you couldn't speak Greek and Latin with them, they didn't think you were deserving enough to be at the university. Du Bois had race pride. Now, let's give it to me, race pride. He just felt that he should have been over. And that was a little envy between Garvey and Booker T. But I just want to say that. I just respond to, I hate, it's like hitting below the belt. You just make up a lie about something. You know, and I just kind of, I see too much of that going on in discourse, in conversation about slavery. Slavery is trivialized. Okay, that's one, that's a dishonest discussion. And it's going to get to the point that by us not teaching our young people, some of these lies will get printed in books and be taught in these schools. And I'm afraid that's going to be coming. Did you hear about Mr. Washington, the school administrator in Texas, who were talking to teachers and telling them, because they're actually going out and pulling books out of libraries now. They're pulling books out of libraries that they don't like. So this school administrator told a teacher that if you're teaching books about the Holocaust, find some books that have a different perspective. See, that school board had to hurt and quickly apologize when he came out. This is what's going on. And I'm just so frustrated that people like Mr. Pianki participate in this type of campaign of misinformation that's being put out here. It's almost like some kind of conspiracy or concerted effort on some soldiers or employees of this movement to go in certain circles and spit all this lies and poison out. And if we don't watch ourselves, white people will be saying that black people own them as slaves. And I don't put it past these white folks to print books in schools like that and have our turn going in. That black people own white people and mistreated white people as slaves, that's why white people had to defend themselves and be racist against blacks. I see that kind of logic coming. Thank you, Mr. Washington.
I just want to say this, and then we'll turn it over to Ms. Pianki for the closing. I did find the information I was looking for in this biography of Du Bois, and this is what it says. It says, where and how Mary Sylvania, that was Du Bois' mother, met Alfred Du Bois, elude the historian and genealogist, at least for the present. Alfred may have made his way to Great Barrington, 1867. Small and beautiful of face and feature, just tinted with the sun, his wavy hair chiefly revealing his kinship to Africa. There's a quote. It doesn't give a footnote here where it comes from anyway. But going on, it says his people were free people of color. So obviously he wasn't a white person. Descended from Dr. James Du Bois of Poughkeepsie, New York, a wealthy physician of French Huguenot origins, which is, that's my background on the on my father's side from that same group of people, but I won't go into that today. That's where my legal name, Cabinets, comes from those French people. James Dubois' family had chosen the cause of King George III over that of George Washington, receiving as a reward from the British Crown extensive land in the Bahamas. Now, this is a white man named Dr. James Dubois. A few years later, the Dubois's and their cousins, the Gilberts, had spread their plantation holdings to Haiti. On the island of Long Cay in the Bahamas, James, this is Dr. James Dubois, James sired at least three sons and a daughter of his slave mistresses. And that's something I think you said a few minutes ago about his parentage. His Dubois great-grandfather, Dr. James Dubois, was dabbling with the slave mistresses and had three sons and a daughter. And I won't go into the rest of the details, but I just want to make that point that I did find the information that establishes without a shadow of a doubt that Dubois' father was what would be considered then and now as a Negro. And I don't think Dubois ever tried to run away from that fact. But you're right. He was maybe called a mulatto in a sense, but truly he wasn't even a true mulatto, because a true mulatto, according to the definition, was one who had a white parent and who had like a white father, black mother, white mother, black father. But Du Bois' daddy, who was named Alexander, was considered to be a Negro. He wasn't a white man. And so Alpha was not even a mulatto in that sense, even though he might have looked like a Frenchman. But, yeah. Anyway, I think it's very important that we do check each other with facts. I'd like to make sure that those who are listening, and we do have a broad spectrum of people listening. As I say this, when I look at the stats, there are three times as many people, and maybe sometimes more, that listen that you never know because they don't come on and talk, but they're learning, and we want to make sure they get the right information. That's why I wanted to go to this publication. This is a two-volume biography of Dubois to be able to get that clear, get that straight. And I think that we're moving in the right direction in terms of the kind of civility that I've always wanted us to be able to have in spite of our differences of opinion or even sometimes the need to be checked as far as our facts are concerned. So I consider myself, even as a professor, to be able to be checked by my students, but I try to make sure I don't give them anything that I can't find a source, a credible source for. But, I don't have a problem with students telling me that I need to check something that I did. I had it happen twice today. It wasn't about some facts in history. It was about some technical issue. And one of them was something I thought I had set up, something to make it easy for the students to hear one of my lectures online. Because of some technical problem, several of them couldn't hear it. Some of them could, some of them couldn't. And I had to apologize for the inconvenience. I don't feel bad about that. We all working towards perfection. None of us are perfect. So anyway, Ms. Bianchi, you're the co-host, and so we want to do as we always do, to have your final closing commentary. But before we do that, I just want to invite our other two panelists, say John Kenan Bay, and you again, Brother One, if anybody wants to make one final statement, quick statement, before we close, before Ms. Bianchi closes out, please go ahead. So we'll start with Sheikh John. Would you like to make a final quick closing statement?
No, not this time. I'm really, really enjoying, and I really appreciate the way we're approaching this information and bringing as much proof as possible to support it.
Okay, thank you. Brother Warren, would you like to make a closing quick statement?
Yeah, I have a question. I was wondering, Mr. Pianchi, the Dockery Christian Academy, what's the status of that school?
The who?
The Dockery Christian Academy you and Rev. Dockery is supposed to be opening up.
I ain't Mr. Dockery. You mean Mr. Dockery, the man you called a greasy preacher? I don't know. I'm not. Me and him are not supposed to be opening up anything. Why don't you come on his show and ask him?
I thought you said that there will be a Dr. Christian Academy, and I thought that you would get some investment.
Well, let me correct you. I never said that.
Okay,
and him are not working to start a school.
Well,
would
that not be an example of just all talk? Would that not be an example of just talk?
Of him?
Well, both of you. You're talking about opening up a school?
No, it wouldn't be because I built 11 schools in the St. Louis area.
Well, we're talking about the Dr. Christian Academy that was promoted.
I never had. How many times do I have to tell you, and I don't understand what it is that I'm saying that you don't understand, I and him was never going to open up a school. Where'd you get that idea from? But that's okay. You don't have to explain. It's okay.
I heard it with my own ears. But anyway, Mr. Washington, it's accuracy. We have to tell the truth. And I think that too many people have political agendas, and they want to approach this issue of racism, and they want to be deceptive. And they assume people don't know. And generally, in a lot of these conversations on Blog Talk, many of your listeners and participants, including a lot of these younger people in their 40s on down, they really have no command of African-American history. So sometimes the older person may come in and give the impression, but really distort a lot of facts. But I'm the kind of person, I stop that kind of stuff. I stop that. I call it. I've always been like that. You're not going to lie in my presence at all. I'm going to call you out. I'm going to jack you off the stage.
You and I both carry that same sentiment. I just hate it when I hear black Americans say they ancient Egyptians. That's so far from the truth that I don't know how to tell you.
Well, you're the one got a Cushite name. I don't know why you got a Cushite name. You ought to get married with your own self.
Cushite, let me correct you because you're putting out some misinformation. Cushites and ancient Egyptians are not the same.
They were African people. They had African languages.
Listen, my birth certificate name is just that, what I go by. And I'm telling you, Cushites and what you call ancient Egyptians in the north were not the same.
They were Africans. They were African.
They were not using
that
word. They were not using that word. Libyans are Africans, right?
They were Africans such as Ethiopians today and Sudanese today. Are Nigerians today and Ghanaians today? They were African.
Well, that's not true because
John Kerry's wife is African too.
Three people talking at the same time.
Well, anyway,
yes,
the
history that we are talking about, we have history go back before the Atlantic Ocean. So a lot of information about Egypt is interpretation and it's very incorrect. So how do you say that?
Who is the we that you talk about goes back before the Atlantic Ocean?
I'm talking about the Father and the Son. And his children of the
Father
creation.
And the Son, as far as religion is concerned?
No, as far as creation. The creation. Jesus of Nazareth is the Son of the Father, who is Allah. And the Son, you can talk to him and communicate with him today, in the present day, if you so desire.
I don't usually like to get in discussions on religion as I could. But I really don't like to get in there. So if that's what you think, that's the way you feel, it's perfectly fine.
Right. I really not saying that because what you said about the ancient Egyptian, that we are not one and the same. They are not our ancestors.
You're not.
So I
they
had to step
different.
In.
Yeah, they, black Americans.
Same bloodline. We have the same bloodline.
Black American. Let me tell you one reason why. Because they God forbid mixing. Cushite God forbid it mixing. It's
well,
in the Bible. Do not give your. It's in the Bible. It's in the Bible. Do not give your sons to their daughters and your daughters to their sons.
Yeah, I'm not supporting amalgamation. I'm not supporting
in black today. In black today,
we
have a percentage.
I think Brother Warren's trying to say something to me. Hold on, everybody.
Yeah, I'm about to get off the line.
What did you say, Brother Warren?
I want you to Google.
Warren, what'd you say?
I want you to Google Mr. Washington Menes, M-E-N-E-S, Anama, the first pharaoh to unite up in Lower Egypt. Look at him and tell me where would he be in Alabama in 1950 or 60.
What's his name?
His name was not Menes.
I need to hear.
Go ahead, Mr. Washington.
Brother Warren, what's his spelling?
M-E-N-E-S. There is a face carving. M-E-N-E-S.
Yeah, I've heard of Menes, right, okay.
And look at the face carving and tell me where would that guy be in Alabama in 1950s or 60s or 40s, and where would he be?
Okay, just 1 minute. I'm bringing it up now. I'm trying to find a picture.
Yeah, just Google image. Google image. You could do Menes or Norman.
Yeah, I'm doing it. Okay. Yeah, I've got his picture now. Yeah, well, looking at his picture, he would have probably experienced the same thing I experienced when I was in Decatur, Alabama in 1958 when I wanted to go in a restaurant to get something to eat, and the waitress told me that I couldn't get served in there because they didn't serve Negroes, and she told me I had to go around to the back, to the kitchen, and they made feed me back there. He would have probably experienced that same thing I did because...
And you got European blood, he would not be considered
to be a white person. If he showed up down in Decatur, Alabama, walking with me, we both would have got put out. Looking at the picture.
The Sultan was not named. Menes is a Greek name, so stop putting out that miseducation. If you're going to name those Sultans, name them by...
Can I just find him on the internet?
They got plenty of pictures of...
That was the person who gave him that name.
Yeah.
You found him under that name,
That wasn't his name.
And I got him.
Yeah, that wasn't his name. So if you're going to
Google search, a lot of pictures came up.
Yeah, a lot of pictures come up. You know, I walked though. You reading the book? I walked through that land for about 9-10 years. And the man's name, the Sultan's name, is Norma wasn't his strong name. Menes surely wasn't. His name was Ah. That's what I tell you about. You can't miss what you never had. And believe me.
Was so Mr. Washington could find the image under the name that's commonly used for him. I'm not debating on what his actual name was and what was at the time. It was to make it easy to find him with that name. That's the point. So it's
well,
not
what about
it?
So I'm telling you that the Cushites and the Egyptians weren't the same. So why was he forcefully trying to unite them? He was forcefully trying to unite them as allies to fight against the Hyksos.
I walked through that land.
Yeah, well, anyway,
you ain't never been to Egypt.
I walked through that land.
You ain't never been to Egypt.
Can we consider this? Next week, I've been to Egypt. I've seen the pictures. I've seen
which pyramids did you go into, Miss Washington?
Yes, I went through the Great Pyramid. But let me tell you this real quick story. Please bear with me. So they had it set up where we could go. I was with a group of people from this Navy ship that I was on, and they had it set up so that we could go inside of the Great Pyramid, the biggest one, the three pyramids of Giza, the main biggest one. They had to set up where we could go actually inside. Okay, so we went through this door, and then there was this long ladder that went down to the bottom, what seemed to be the bottom floor, right? It was like dirt, really, down there. Might have been some slate or marble at one time, but it seemed like it was dirt down there when we got down there. But what was in there was two things that were very significant. One was total triple darkness, and they had a string of light bulbs. I mean, it was very primitive. They had a string of light bulbs going from the top, going down there to the bottom to provide a little bit of light. Wasn't a lot of light. And then in the middle of this space where we, when we went down the ladder, was this tomb. Well, it was like erected above the ground, probably about 4 feet high, but big enough to put a casket in there, or some sarcophagus, whatever you want to call it, put a casket in there. Now, here was the thing, and I don't believe in no whole lot of superstition and spookiness, but there was a bunch of white guys, and you know how these young white boys sometimes, they don't really respect, you know, revere, you know, some things that they should revere. So they decided they wanted to jump inside of the tomb and play dead, you know, just like they making fun of the whole idea. And as soon as the white boy jumped in there, the lights went out. I don't know if it was just some accident with the electric, because it was like you're an engineer, so you know, of course, and I'm sure the rest of you know what a series circuit is. You unscrew one of the bulbs, they're all going to go out. And I don't know if it was because one of the bulbs went bad, but all of those bulbs' light went out. And it was so dark, and I have never experienced that kind of darkness in my life. And here I'm in the bottom of the pyramid, total trip of darkness. And I'm thinking, now, why in the world do these white boys want to come in here and be messing up like this? Not that there was any relationship, you know, but it was the two things that I remember very clearly about that tour over there to the pyramids. And I went to the Egyptian Museum as well, and I saw some very interesting artifacts over there. The National Museum in Cairo, but also another thing, and I'm going to say this, I'm going to be quiet because I do want to close out in a second and let you, you know, finish up with the closing, Ms. Bianchi, but in that same Giza area near the Great Pyramid was a wall which was, according to one of the Egyptians, supposed to have been part of the temple, and they say that this is really a temple that was dedicated to Ramses or something like that. But on the wall, they had this history in hieroglyphics. Now, here was the interesting thing about what, and this is supposed to be like 5,000 years old, but here was the interesting thing about it. They showed different epochs of Egyptian history. One epoch, the real dark Egyptian. You know, I'm not going to say it was a real, real black Egyptian, but they were dark. You could see them in the role of being the king or the pharaoh. Then another epoch, you could see a more lighter copper-colored Egyptian being the king or the pharaoh and the other people serving him. And then another epoch, you could see white-looking people be the king or the pharaoh. And this is like on their wall. It's not something some artists came in there and just put up there for the tourists. Because what I was told, this had been there for thousands of years. And I just say, that's very interesting because it definitely coincides with what I have studied. I'm not an Egyptologist, but I have studied something about Egyptian history and about the different waves of conquerors and assimilation and all this kind of stuff. But I will say this, from everything I've ever studied, that those original people, we were just talking about the people of Kush, the people from Nubia, the people from Sudan, these were some very dark-skinned people. And when I went into the National Museum of History in Cairo, they actually had statues of these real black Egyptians, and they weren't slaves. They were like kings and things. So it's just fascinating to me to see, and my point is to see how there's such a dynamic of change in terms of the color power, if you want to call it that. So what that tells me in my conclusion is that for the last 6,000 years, and maybe not as long as that, but certainly for the last couple thousand years, the white Caucasian has been in power. But if you look at that, just that one depiction I just told you about, history tells me that that's going to change one day. And I remember Martin Luther King telling me, and he wasn't talking to me one-on-one, but I was in a small audience in a church, and he was talking to the group. There's probably about 40 of us in that group. And he said that he could foresee that one day he didn't use the word dynamic, but one day the power dynamic was going to flip, and the people, us black people that's on the bottom, would be on the top. But I can say this in my conclusion. I hope to goodness that if we ever get in that position, we get to be more united than we are today. That's all I want to say.
Well,
so Mr. Pianchi,
I want to ask Mr. Pianchi, what did Herodotus say how the Egyptians looked? Be honest, what did Herodotus say?
What do you mean, what did Herodotus say?
Like the Egyptians had black skin.
Ethiops is a Greek word for burnt face.
But
it was
he referred to the Egyptians as well. What did he say? Now you're being dishonest.
Here's the thing, Warren. I have so much on that. I cannot jump to one thing just like that. What did he say?
He said, like the Ethiopians, the Egyptians had black skin and woolly hair.
What year did he say that?
In the 800 B.C. he said that.
All right. Nabra was of the fourth dynastic period. You're talking about 2500 B.C., before the Common Era. Herodotus didn't live back during that time.
You're missing the point. The ancient Egyptians prior to major invasion were essentially a people that were African, like other Africans on the continent.
No, they were not like other Africans on the continent. They was different.
Again, you just
Matt Sparrow said. Matt Sparrow. What did Matt Sparrow say about
it?
Hang on for a second. Why don't you let somebody talk? You want
to
go? You go ahead and talk. When you get done talking, let us know.
You're being dishonest.
I'm not being dishonest. You won't let me talk. Go ahead and let them.
You're being dishonest. The DNA, the skeletal remains, it all shows that we quintessentially, the dynastic period and pre-dynastic period.
What part of Africa are you talking about? The word Africa wasn't even used back during that time. People did not identify themselves as being the whole continent.
If they were living today,
that is not true. You're lying. You've never been there. You read something out of a book. You let me know that when you make the mention of Herodotus.
I've been to Egypt with Dr. Ben Price and Renoho Rashidi. I've been three times, fool.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. Where'd you stay at?
Shit.
I don't
okay,
know no
listen,
hotel
I got
called
to go,
shit.
Folks.
Where you stay at?
Listen, let's be civil, but I have to go. I had planned to be out of here at least by 9:30.
Where did you stay at?
Yeah. But anyway, Mr. Washington, I went with Dr. Ben back in the
80s. What year did you go with Dr. Ben?
I had a chance to go to Egypt. And so I'm very familiar with the various arguments.
What year did you go?
To say that Egypt was not an African.
Well, I tell you what, you say you went, wait a minute. You went those years. Show me a visa that was stamped in your passport for the years you say you went with Dr. Ben.
Hey, guys. I'm going to have to go, so I'm going to close out the show. I wanted Ms. Bianchi to do a wrap-up, but I guess we have wrapped up enough.
Yeah, let me close out the show,
please.
I don't want to be rude.
I'm trying to be civil.
You keep them, mute them, and I close out the show.
Uh, I, I guess I must be on mute. Let me see. Am I on mute? I'm not on mute. I'm talking to myself.
No, you're not
on
mute.
What
I'm saying, if you mute them, I can close out the show.
No. I think we all grown enough to be able to go ahead and let you do the closing, and we can bring this up next
week. I don't
think
so, because he's going to be cutting in. That's his habit.
No, I don't think, Brother One. If I ask Brother One to hold off, and we'll get back on this next week. I do want to say, I just pulled it up, and Herodotus did say, he said that they were black. He did say that. He said he had woolly hair. You know, we see, you know, that Herodotus, he visited Egypt, and he said the Egyptians were, that he saw, had black skin and woolly hair. But let's go with the closing right now. We can
Well, let me close out on that. Herodotus lived around 800 B.C., and as Warren said, and you're talking about the Shem who... the Shemhu Heru period of time goes back to 10,000 years. So he wasn't around during that time. Nobody classified themselves according to that whole continent. They classified themselves to the land. Matter of fact, if you look at what was considered the known world at that time, even with the maps of Ptolemy, it didn't carry down into what we call the Sahel or the Sahara.
Okay, well, good.
Another
is
point, when they said, when
up,
they made mention... This is a wrap up. When they made mention, don't marry your, don't give your sons to their daughter, your daughter to their son. They wasn't talking about white skinned people. There wasn't any around of no determination at that time. They was talking about other Asians and also other Egyptians. They was ethnocentric, just like many tribes are in Africa today.
Okay,
so
that's a good rap.
But we can still say that.
Let's let that be the rap.
Skin color
don't mean.
Can we
let that be the rap for tonight?
This is the rap, and I'll leave. Skin color.
We shake after Joe, Mr. Washington. Read Dr. Yosef Benyakin.
Skin color.
Listen to people who are experts in the subject.
I thought you were going to ask him to be quiet, Mr. Washington. Can you carry your classroom like this?
No. We all know.
There was no DNA sequencing during the time of the great Check out of Diop. By the way, he was married to a white. Well, that's okay. People do what they got to do.
Can we close on that?
You just bragged on a Nigerian with a white wife. You say it was a beautiful couple.
Come on, Jack. Guys, listen. I got to go.
Warren, like I told you, Warren.
All right, here we go.
Warren, show me your visa.
I got to go. I'm trying to be nice. I'm trying to tell everybody
nothing.
I got to go, y'all.
Because you
all right,
can't.
Good night. God bless. And everybody have a good evening. Have a good weekend.
All right,
and
Mr. Washington. All right, thank you, Mr. Washington. Thank you.
All right, thank y'all. Thank you very much. Thank you.